The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, last time we were looking at Martin Heidegger, and we looked at Martin, what is called Martin Heidegger's early period. And now I want to look at Jean-Paul Sartre, also his early period. His dates run from 1905 to 1980. He was born on June 21, 1905 in Paris, and he died on April 15, 1980. Now, if we then have looked at certain characteristics of existentialism, if we have then looked at some of the problems connected with it, we then looked at one major figure, namely Martin Heidegger, his early period, and now we turn to the early position of Jean-Paul Sartre. And this is associated with his writing Being and Nothingness. Being and Nothingness. And and until recently, when there was reference to existentialism, it was likely Jean-Paul Sartre and his followers who were in mind. And it was a group then that followed his thinking in this early work of his, this early major work. Now, this was then regarded as being typical of existential thinking, this writing Being and Nothingness. And Sartre was regarded to be the existentialist Bursang, or he was a pure-blooded existentialist. He was the existentialist par excellence. Now, he received his early inspiration from Martin Heidegger, from the work of Heidegger, What is Metaphysics? Now, we shall see later on that Heidegger maintained that Sartre misunderstood him. But nevertheless, he did draw from Heidegger's book, What is Metaphysics? As I said, Heidegger complained that Sartre did not truly understand his intentions, but it was Heidegger, and particularly this book, that set Jean-Paul Sartre on his way and to his own influential expression of what existential thought was. We're dealing with Jean-Paul Sartre, J-E-A-N-P-A-U-L and S-A-R-T-R-E, Jean-Paul Sartre. Now, I already said at the very, very beginning of the course that the existential thinking that had come to expression in Germany between the First and the Second World War was nearly moribund. It had, we mentioned that Kierkegaard's writings had been translated into German, and it was when these writings became known and the time seemed to be ripe that existential thinking had a vogue. But this thinking was nearly moribund in Germany until it was again brought to attention by the work of Jean-Paul Sartre, and also a person whom we have mentioned before already, Albert Camus. Those Sartre and Camus were those who brought it again to attention. Now, during the Second World War, Jean-Paul Sartre was a prominent figure in the French resistance movement, and this brought him into attention. And this assured his popularity after the war. Some of you who did not live through that war, I think, will have a difficult time understanding the intensity of the reactions to it. It was a very serious time indeed, and many countries, of course, had been overrun by the Germans there with their efficient fighting machine. And there was a resistance movement in France. I know personally of some of the resistance movement in the Netherlands because my father-in-law participated in it. And it was a very serious matter, and people had to put their lives on the line all the time in this resistance movement. And people who were prominent in it would also get the public eye, particularly afterward, of course, when their participation became known. When then Jean-Paul Sartre emerged as a philosopher, the exponent of a novel position, exponent of a new position that dovetailed with the chaotic conditions of post-war France, he obtained a huge following. There was a chaotic situation after the war when he emerged then as a philosopher with a new position, with a novel position that dovetailed with this chaotic condition. He obtained a huge following. And in the wake of Sartre's success, there was a renewed interest in existential thinking also in Germany. Well, another reason for Sartre's popularity was that his interests were not only philosophical in the academic sense of the word. One very often pulls this word philosophy out of shape. One can hear about the philosophy behind a certain company. We talk about the philosophy which guides us in our activities, sometimes in our Christian activities. Academic philosophy, of course, is a very strict discipline, but the word is used in a broader sense for something that I myself would think of more as a general idea of a general worldview that you have. Well, his interests were not only philosophical in the academic sense of the word, in the strict sense of the word, but his philosophy was spread by other means also. He used a variety of means to spread his thought. He wrote several novels. Some of his novels then are listed in the list of novels I gave to you. He wrote several plays. A couple of his plays are on that list also. He was a frequent contributor to journals, and he was also active in producing several moving pictures, several films. So he was very active in this way. Now, I think that one gains insight into the development of Sartre's early thought by looking at one of his most early literary productions, which has the delightful name Nausea. In French, Nausee. And this was written in 1938. Nausea, for those of you who are not from this country, perhaps you're not familiar with the term very well, is a feeling you have when you become sick to your stomach, and you have a nauseous feeling. Well, this is the delightful title of Sartre's early literary production, La Nausée. Now, this presents itself as a journal. That is a writing, a journal, a, well, shall we say, a journal is something in which you write something down, what happens to you then from day to day. Well, this is a journal of the historical investigator, and he talks in Antoine. Antoine Roquentin. That's the name of the fellow. Antoine is a lonely, colorless intellectual, and he is separated, he is alienated from the world. He is only an observer of life. He doesn't really participate in life. He then is an observer of life. And in his attitude toward life, he views everything just as he does the object of his historical study. He is writing on the Count of Rollebon. There's a count of which, on whom he is writing, and Antoine views everything just like his investigation of this historical study, the Count of Rollebon. Now, in this writing, Sartre expressed one of the fundamental moods that emerged from the experience of the war, and we have mentioned that already. It is the sense of the absurd, the sense of the absurd. And this, as we mentioned, was a theme that was elaborated extensively by Albert Camus. I mentioned him just a moment ago, by the one of those who reintroduced existential thinking. This is a theme, then, that was presented by Sartre and also by Camus. We find a description here of how the absurd breaks into human life and destroys the superficial meaning of it, the meaningfulness of life. I have presented this thought earlier to you. I've talked about the envelope of meaning, an envelope of meaning that is built up. We might also think of it in terms of some kind of a balloon, a kind of a balloon of meaning that is filled up and is inflated then and is able to rise above the ground. According to this idea here of Sartre and Camus, there is something that enters in what they call the absurd that destroys the meaningfulness of this meaningfulness that we have built up. We might say it deflates our balloon or it destroys the envelope of meaning. Well, the idea then too, quite definitely, is that if we have built up this meaning, then we build it up We build it up over the terrain where we have control. If we can control, then we can build meaning, and we build up then the meaning in terms of our valuing, in terms of our activity, and then the idea is that the envelope bursts, the balloon bursts or is deflated, and this meaning is destroyed. And that experience, the experience of the eruption, you might say, not eruption like you might have with a volcano, but the I-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N, the eruption of meaning or the breaking in of meaning into our lives is a fundamental theme in the early Sartre and also in Camus. Now, how does that appear? It appears here, for one thing, with the thought of the irreversibility of time. This is thought to introduce an element of meaninglessness here. And Sartre expresses this idea with the picture of a woman who is growing old. Antoine sees an old woman, and the thought strikes him that time is not irreversible. We are that time is not reversible, excuse me, that time is not reversible, and that we are then on our way and that we must then die. So, human life is set up over against nature. If you're investigating nature, this is a very widespread idea, then if you have a scientific experiment, if you know how to perform the experiment, you can write down the rules and your results and presumably perform it again. But life is not like that. Time is not like that because it keeps on going on and it is irreversible, and one then has, like this old woman, has to go on. One has to grow old. One must face old age and eventually die. More characteristic of the volume is Sartre's analysis of the experience of what we call at the seminary here brute fact or facticity. There's a day when Antoine is simply sitting in a park, and his trusted everyday interpretation of things fall away, and he is suddenly confronted with being in all of his bruteness, the just there-ness of being. Now, I mentioned that there's the influence of phenomenology in this type of thinking. Phenomenological thinking tried to analyze common everyday things. And here we find a reflection of that in Sartre's novel. Antoine is just going about his business. He's just sitting in the park. He's not doing anything unusual. He's not trying to write some grand essay. He's not trying to write a book on philosophy. He's not composing some great poem or painting a work of art or something like that. He's just sitting there. And his trusted everyday interpretation of things falls away, and he is suddenly confronted with being in all of its bruteness, in its just there-ness. He throws a stone, or he picks up a stone to throw it. He drops it. He turns away distracted. It's an ordinary everyday event. He's not at a great major a historical turning point or anything like that. But inwardly, there is an undefined mood or impression. He's suddenly impressed with the absurdity of reality. Now, I've kept on saying here that the fundamental experience that in existential thinking is an experience for which you cannot give any rationale. You can't find any ground for it. You can't find any reason for it. It simply wells up brutally, irrationally within you, and that is what we have here. There is an undefined mood. There is an undefined feeling in terms of which he is then impressed with the absurdity of reality. There's something strange about it. Another characteristic we have seen that in one's world, the world he makes, he feels at home. But when this experience, this corresponds to the experience of angst, of which we have spoken already, there is this idea of Unheimlichkeit, that one then does not feel at home. There's something strange about it. And reality then, according to this novel, reveals its craziness. There, it just doesn't make sense. It reveals its craziness. As Sartre put it, and as he would put it, Antoine is faced with the massivity of being. Now, what kind of a feeling might that be? I tried very, very hard over a fair number of years to work my way into existential thinking, to try to imagine vividly what these people thought that they experienced or what they were trying to describe. One of these is the massivity of being. Well, one of the most massive things I'd ever have ever seen is the great outcropping of rock in Yellowstone Park, El Capitan. I don't know whether any of you have seen it or not, but a tremendous massif of granite there. Now, there's the idea then that something confronts one as if it were a massif, a great stone massif, and that is just overpowering. It's overpowering. It then, as it were, just simply takes one in its grip, and this experience of brute facticity, of the massivity of being, appears to Antoine as a what he calls a nausea. And here this theme of existential thinking comes in, is only when you then have had such an emotion. Only when the facade of meaning has fallen away, only when the envelope of meaning has been broken, the meaning which has been impressed on it by the valuing of our everyday life, is only then that true being has been revealed. And so we find that there is an experience here that is correlate to the experience of angst in the thought of Martin Heidegger. Now, in this volume, Sartre's philosophy revolves around this dichotomy, namely of the envelope of meaning and then this experience of nausea and the destruction, the eruption of meaninglessness into this everyday experience. In everyday experience, as we said, we live in a world that is filled with meaning. It's a meaning that has been placed there by human valuing. This world has quality. There's quality about it. There are distinctions, there is valuations, there are degrees of value, there are qualitative differences in things. However, this is only the garb or the mantle which has been thrown over bare existence by human activity. Look deep, look in the background, and you will find then just this bare existence, this massivity of being in which there is no meaning at all. So this is the experience of the shock of that which is purely given. You do not understand existential thinking, as I've said, unless you realize that the envelope of meaning, this meaningfulness, must be shocked. It must be shocked by that which is purely given, that which is altogether gratuitous, without any reason or ground of being. Now, if we then have this nausea, if we then are impressed by the massivity of being, we become aware that this facticity, the facticity of existence, cannot be referred back to anything. There's no ground for it whatsoever. If you should introduce the idea of the Creator, if you should introduce the idea of the fact that this world is created, that there's a created order or anything like that, then, of course, that cannot be an existential experience. The facticity cannot be referred back to anything, a creator, created order, or whatever. It is the absurd, it is the meaningless in its pure givenness. Now, Sartre here then, also in existentialist fashion, however, does not see this pure facticity as being simply empty. There, for existential thinking, you must have the encounter with nothingness. There must be the encounter with this facticity. But there is a mood there that is supposed to carry someone farther, farther along. Now, in the experience, he goes on, our mood of nausea, one has the feeling that existence is overpowering him. I mentioned that meaning, according to this way of thinking, is connected with human control. If we have control over things, then we can create this envelope of meaning. But in the experience of nausea, one has the feeling that existence is overpowering him. And he senses existence as being too much. The French expression, which is used quite often, is de trop. D-E-T-R-O-P. It's just too much. It's an overpowering thing that is too much. This is an overbearing sensation of the massivity, the senselessness of being. As I say, in this, one becomes, has this mood of nausea. So everything that exists, exists ultimately without sense. He says, it exists out of weakness and then finally dies. Now, when one says something like that, that existence continues on simply out of weakness, one might find an entranceway here to the thought that a good number of people have had, that the brave thing to do, that the thing that to assert yourself is to commit suicide. Now that, I have said all along, is not a typical attitude, I mean, among the deeper existential thinkers. It was more of a fad idea. Nevertheless, there is some approach to this in the thought that existence continues on out of weakness and then in dies. Now, Antoine then wonders whether there's any sense in life at all if this happens to him. And if he has this feeling, this mood of nausea, and everything seems to be too much, is there any sense in life at all. Now, near the end of his stay in the town, however, he goes to a cafe, and there he hears a negress sing. And for him, that is a great experience. And he thinks that this provides a clue, to existence. At least this negress, this black woman, and at least the songwriter in his composition had justified, at least to a small degree. So, as I say, the idea of nausea is not just simply negative, but as in so many existential thinkers, there is the attempt to go through and to find something on the other side. Here we find a kind of a solution found in aesthetic direction, in terms of a meaningful activity. I've always found it very strange that suddenly the idea comes up here of justifying your existence. Because if you're going to be an existential thinker in the first place, you have to eliminate all justifications of existence. You have to have eliminated them. And then to bring them back again, what does that mean? However, let me say this. We can remark two things. That again and again, there is supposed to be the swing through nothingness, and so we can get beyond it. Here, at least, there's a suggestion of that. And these are supposed to be justifying their existence, at least to a small degree, by the singing and by the writing of songs. And so Antoine decides then that he's going to write a book. He wants to write a book that will make men ashamed of their existence. And he has then wants to shed some light on his past so that he can say, now I have made a new beginning. Now there is a new beginning for me. There's another comment that one might make, and that's this, that after all, in spite of the greatest efforts to level out everything in God's creation, and to come up with this idea of meaninglessness, just to have the idea that you can find reality only with the destruction of all meaning, the creation of God just does not lie down flat. It does just simply lie down and give up. It will testify to itself. And after all, one has to have some meaningful context for his life. And this idea of justification of existence comes in again after the destruction of all meaning. Well, one then can put his life in proper perspective, according to this attitude, only when one has been confronted with the brute factuality of being. It is in the experience of the absurd that we find the only form of spiritual awareness and human worth. We have another paradox here. One point of discussion, one point of argument about the thought of Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre, is this relationship to humanism. Because Jean-Paul Sartre wrote an essay, Existentialism is a Humanism. Well, what do you mean by that? Existentialism, a humanism, when, first of all, you have to destroy all human values. One might say, well, it's a humanism because only with this can true human worth be realized. Well, that apparently is one thought here. I, of course, don't share that. We don't share that position. But the thought is that one can place his life in proper perspective only when he has been faced with the experience of the absurd, only here can one find the form of spiritual awareness and human worth. And in this book, a solution is attempted in the direction of artistic creation. One then can develop himself as an autonomous, free personality in an endless effort, an endless artistic striving. Now that, we might say, can be a romantic notion. It is a notion that was prominent in the thought of Johann Gottlieb Fichte, is the striving, really, that's the important thing. But there's an attempt to find some meaning here, then, in an endless effort and endless artistic striving. And so, just a few words, then, about this novel. And then we turn to his main work, this work of which we spoke, Lettre et le Néant, or Being and Nothingness. Now, in this work, Sartre develops his thoughts around a fundamental distinction between being in itself, and being for itself. Being in itself, being, to use the French term that is so often used, being en soi, and being for itself, being pour soi. The fundamental distinction in this writing. This fundamental distinction, then, he derives out of an analysis of pre-theoretical consciousness. Now here again, you have a motive that comes to us, or a motif that comes to us out of phenomenology. We mentioned that the phenomenologist was interested in describing, not necessarily great events and so forth, but common everyday experiences. We found Antoine in the park. Something happens to him of great significance. When this envelope of meaning falls away, he's not doing some great thing. He's just sitting there. He just picks up a rock, let's say, to throw it, and he drops it, and he has this experience, just ordinary, everyday things. Well, here again, this comes out of an analysis of a pre-theoretical consciousness. One is not involved in some big scientific thing or writing a book of philosophy, let's say, but simply an examination then of pre-theoretical consciousness. Sartre finds in pre-theoretical consciousness a directedness toward an object. In the pre-theoretical, he finds a directedness, D-R-I-E-C-T-E-D-N-E-S-S, directedness toward an object. In other words, what is called an intention. There is an intention or an intentional relatedness in our pre-theoretical experiencing toward an object, toward something particular. All consciousness, he says, is intentionally directed to something. Intentionally directed to something. something particular. At the same time, in this pre-theoretical awareness, he says, where there is always a directedness to something, something particular, there is also an awareness, there is also a consciousness of self. And so, before one would involve himself in science, before one would involve himself in philosophy, before one would involve himself some of these activities of which we have been speaking, artistic creation and so forth, there is a directedness to an object, to something, and then there is what he calls a non-reflective awareness of oneself, a non-reflective awareness of oneself. So you have then both directions, directed it towards something, something particular, and at the same time, there is what he calls a non-reflective awareness or a consciousness of self. Now, I have difficulty with this terminology here, and I'll tell you why. As far as I can see, what he means by non-reflective would be the same as being non-theoretical. That if he uses the term reflection here, if you're reflective, then you're reflecting theoretically. And so since this is pre-theoretical, then he calls it a non-reflective awareness of yourself. As far as I understand things from a Christian point of view, it seems to me that in our lives there is always a reflection on ourselves, no matter what we do. There is always a reflection on oneself, and that comes out in such phenomena as conscience, for example. In our relationship to the gospel. You cannot read anything about the gospel without reflecting in some way upon yourself. In our response to God, there is a reflection on ourselves. There is the attempt in so many persons to protect themselves against this awareness that they are sinners and so forth. Seems to me that we can talk about a reflection that is a pre-theoretical reflection. But as far as I can see, Sartre is not doing it that way. He talks about a non-reflective awareness of oneself, an awareness of oneself that is there before one might take up the work of reflection or of theoretical thinking in science, let's say, or in philosophy. Now, these two directions in their unity, namely, the going out toward, the directedness toward, the intention toward an object, and a pre-reflective awareness of oneself, these things together, he called the pre-reflective cogito. He called the pre-reflective cogito. So you have to immediately think on these two directions as the pre-reflective cogito. And in true phenomenological fashion, Sartre found here, or discovered here, the foundation for all reflective theoretical acts of consciousness. This then would be a framework then. You find a framework within which your science and your philosophy and other things then would be cradled. This would be the frame then within which they operate. Now, it's upon this pre-reflective cogito then, in these two aspects, that Sartre founds this dichotomy, namely of being in itself and being for itself, or being en soi and being pour soi. Because if this pre-reflective cogito holds, we are at once directed toward being in itself, but at the same time, we are aware of ourselves, and we are aware of ourselves as being for itself. So here's the foundation for his distinction of being in itself and being for itself. Now, in order to develop this further, Sartre then begins to talk about consciousness. Consciousness, which is founded in this self-awareness here, awareness of self, is nothing. It is nothing in itself. The only being it has is in its directedness toward the object which is transcendent to it. That is, if I am involved here in directedness toward something, toward this object, I am nothing in myself. My existence is taken up completely in the direction toward something, in the direction toward the object that is transcendent to me. What is present, then, is being in itself, but being in itself which is never exhausted in my being related to it. So I'm always going out towards something. I'm always going out toward the object. I am nothing in myself. I'm going out toward being itself, but that is never exhausted in my relating to it. Now, this being in itself corresponds to the description of being that was given in Sartre's La Nausée, in this novel of his, this novel, Nausea. It's devoid of any determination. It's devoid of any qualities. It is just blank. It is just simply given. It is just there. It's simply a simple massivity. All determination, all meaning, is the result of the activity of pur soi. Being in itself is simply given. It's simply massivity. All meaning is the activity, is due to the activity of being pur soi. En soi is just there. It is what it is. It simply is what it is. It is pure contingent factuality. And it is then in this being, namely en soi, that Sartre finds his starting point. If we think in terms of Sartre, we have to get a hold of this idea of being itself, being in itself, that is simply given. And anything else then is going to be a negation of it. Here is where he starts, and anything else that we think of has to be understood in relationship to it and by way of negation of it. The only hiatus in this massivity, the only hole, you might say, in this massivity comes through the pur soi. Being for itself, or being pur soi. The pur soi makes a break in being. His massivity, the pur soi makes a break in being. It, you might say, drills a hole in being. It is a nothingness. It is a negation. that comes first with man. And Sartre's thought was that human consciousness is fundamentally negative. It is basically negative. He gives an example. How do I identify myself? I go into a restaurant, and how do I identify myself? I'm not a table. I'm not the waiter. I'm not this. I'm not that. And the other. In other words, I find out who I am. I identify myself. I individualize myself negatively by setting myself over against something, by setting myself, for one thing, over against being and my own pour soi, my consciousness, then is understood negatively. Sartre says then that every affirmation, or the possibility of every affirmation, rests on a prior negation. Anything positive is seen over against its negation. It is not this, it is not that, it is not the other. We understand what things are only by way of negation. And this negative activity then is invariably linked with self-consciousness. This negativity then attaches itself to being for itself, it attaches itself to consciousness, and consciousness is understood only over against, only negating something. So Sartre speaks out against the priority of nothingness. His starting point is being itself, being en soi. Nothingness arises by the activity of the pour soi. But at the same time, this en soi is, being in itself simply is, but in consciousness, in the pour soi, it creates its own negation. It creates its own negation. So we start with en soi, we start with being in itself, but the thought is that this negation somehow arises out of being itself. That's this reference point anyway, and so one can say that in the pour soi, being creates its own negation.